Hello and welcome to On Landscape. We're here with Joe Cornish with some questions raised by our readers recently. So hello, Joe.
Good morning, Sam.
Now, we put these questions up about a week ago and we've had some great responses. And what I'll do is I'll say who the question's from and read the question out and we'll take it from there. So the first question is from Alex Nail. And Alex asks, I'd like to hear an adventure story or two, a tale of bad weather or exhaustion or something along those lines. I've had a few bad trips myself, so I'm sure Joe has a tall tale or two. And they always make for entertaining reading when they end well.
Well, thanks very much, Alex. I think that was, if I can say so, that's probably fairly typical coming from Alex. Not that I've met him, but he's a photographer who's definitely pushed the boat out once or twice, I think.
He likes an adventure.
Judging by his pictures. So I'm kind of slightly embarrassed to answer it by saying that although I've done huge amounts of photography out on the hill over the years, most of my trips are day trips, and especially when I climb in the higher mountains, they're usually made in reasonable weather because I am fairly safety conscious, being a father of two children,
yes,
and not wishing to die just yet. So I have, I try to stay more or less within, let's not call it comfort zone, but
yeah,
within a safety zone. I think in recent years, the closest thing I've had to a really, well, let's say interesting experience was on Ben Eam in the Arakar Alps the day before my 50th birthday. And that was, I got caught in a blizzard fairly high up on the mountain. And the forecast was mixed, but I hadn't expected it to be anything like as vicious or as,
yes,
spectacular as it was. It basically had said sunshine and showers. Well, of course, sunshine and showers down at sea level is sunshine and showers.
It's quite pleasant, isn't it?
Yes, it does, yeah. And it makes for good light, and it's a good photographer's day. But I'd set off before sunrise. It was in early March, you know, so not really short daylight hours. Set off well before sunrise, and I was actually had two kind of goals on the day. One was to photograph the Cobbler, which is a well-known, an interesting shaped mountain in the Southern Highlands, and then to walk past that, and then to climb onto the slopes of Ben Eam. And I had a specific view that I was looking to photograph.
Is this for Scotland's Mountains?
It was for Scotland's Mountains, and as I say, the day before my 50th birthday. I'd managed to get a couple of pictures made in the early light. It was quite nice as the clouds were ebbing and flowing, coming and going. And then essentially I had about an hour and a half hike to get up high up into the shoulders of the main mountain, past the Cobbler, which I managed to get a 5-4 picture of. And as I started climbing, it got cloudier and kind of generally more moody looking, and I was thinking, well, I need to be careful as I go. And then the wind started to pick up, and by the time I was close to the kind of main shoulder of the mountain, but not right on the summit, but high up on the hill, it really, really got bad. And I thought, well, I think I'm just going to try and find some shelter here for a little bit.
Could you see this coming in?
Yes, and it got dark as well. And I managed to find a kind of overhang. It was literally underneath a very large rock overhang. And there was this already a big kind of scoop of snow had essentially developed there where the rock had sheltered the landscape underneath. There was a lot of snow. It was pretty much snow everywhere. And it started to snow really, really heavily and the wind got up. So I thought, well, I'll just hunker down in here for a while and let it blow over. But it's funny how that that time becomes much, much longer than you think it's ever going to take.
You don't know how long it's going
to
last.
No, you don't. You have to be optimistic. But after an hour, I was thinking, well, you know, and at that point, the spindrift had started to accumulate heavily, and I was constantly brushing off the snow off my camera bag and off myself, and I had actually started to build up a wall underneath this overhang, in order to essentially protect me, because I was although the air temperature was about freezing, it wasn't incredibly cold, but it was very damp.
Yeah.
And I had a good kit on, but I was getting cold as well.
You get a lot of turbulent wind behind the rock as well, don't you? Which is why it was probably clear of snow.
That's right. But you kept getting this settling. There was a lot of spindrift coming in, and the wind was I'd howled. I'd left my to begin with, actually, I left my camera bag up on the top, and I went to, and investigated this hollow. And after 10 minutes, I thought, this is bad. I better go and get the camera. So I went out felt a bit like Scott of the Antarctic at that point, going out onto the main ridge again. It's probably only 20, 25 metres away, and already the snow had banked up around the bag. There's this long lee kind of. I grabbed my tripod and bag and took them back down. And so I had this hour, and as I say, it was the hour that felt like a day. And I had my sandwiches, and I started to feel like, well, am I going to be benighted out here?
Could be a birthday.
Interesting birthday treat that would have been. I didn't really fancy it, I have to say, because I didn't have a sleeping bag with me or anything like that, and it just wasn't looking great. And I was starting to feel, let's say, concern. I didn't panic, but I thought, well, the worst case scenario is I'll just back myself right into the hill, bank the snow up around me, and hope for the best. And I was fairly confident that the forecast was fine for the following day. So however, it did blow over, and not long after that I was able to go out and photograph in what was amazing conditions. So I've really never experienced anything quite like that. The aftermath of the blizzard was that the sun came out through these big thick clouds, and the steam was going to rise. It was amazing because it was quite warm, the sun, March, wow. It was starting to have some heat in it. And although it was very, very cold in the lower parts of the valley, there was a lot of mist rising. So wonderful conditions. I wish I could say I made the most of it, but didn't really.
No photograph of the book.
No, there is one, but it was one of the black and white chapter intros.
Right.
I quite like it, but I have to say that emotionally I was absolutely shattered. So I walked. I never even got onto the summit of the mountain. Wandered about a bit and thought, I think the best thing is just to get out of here safely. I felt grateful. And just made the descent through, considerably thicker snow than I'd come up in.
Yeah.
So, that's my little anecdote for whatever it's worth. Not that exciting, really. More recently this year, I had a wonderful trek in Ladakh that was with the family. So not so much a photographic outing, but there were times when we were many days from any kind of safe, what you might call safe place.
Yeah.
And we were up at 4,500 meters, and then 5,500 meters when we crossed the Furt Salar Pass. And although everything went really well, we had great guides. There was one time when Jen felt particularly poorly with the altitude, and I must say I thought, we are 5 days from anywhere. There was no chance of getting a helicopter out there, and I was beginning to worry at that point. Fortunately, she responded really well to dioxin. And we carried on, and we got through the trek fine. But it makes you realise there are times when, it's not the most safe activity in the world.
How do you cope? I mean, on this Benin trip, do you take anything with you in case you get stuck?
Back then I probably did have my mobile with me, but reality is you're never quite sure whether, if you do get stuck, it's going to be any use to you. And often is in Scotland, partly because when you're high, you get better line of sight with the phone signal. I've never called out Mountain Rescue, never want to, hope never to have to, and I greatly admire them and do some fundraising work for them as well. Yeah. So big fan of what they do, but... one doesn't want to trouble them. It's kind of embarrassing to think that would happen.
Unlike the ladies who got tired walking off Trafan
recently
this year and called the Mountain Rescue down because they their feet were sore. Not the right use, possibly. And of course, you had the Larry Grew walk, which we've talked about in a previous issue.
We have, and that was, yes, that was a bit more of an epic in many ways. But I probably didn't have a moment like I had on Benin, no, where I thought things were going to go badly wrong, other than that. Having walked, just to briefly fill you in, this is a walk from a car park at the kind of roadhead at the Lynn of Dee near Braemar, and from there you walk into the mountains, into the heart of the Cairngorm. Larry Grew is regarded by many as the greatest glen in Scotland, because it's the highest, where the base point of the glen is 600 metres above sea level, and you've got Scotland's second, third, fourth, and I think fifth highest mountains,
right,
all around it. And it has a bothy right in the middle of it called the Corua, where I was aiming at. A 7 mile walk is not really particularly challenging ordinarily for a fit person, even carrying 20 kilograms or so of kit. But it took me all day to do that 7 miles because of the snow.
Deep snow.
Conditions, deep snow, a lot of crusted snow. So there's quite a lot of standing and breaking through, and you get that, it's just...
Tiring.
Yeah. Yes, I could use more fruity phrases for it, but it is tiring. And by the time the sun had set, I just got my first eye line of Karoo, and at that point it was still best part of 2 miles away.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of moment thinking, am I going to make it before it gets dark? And because I knew that it was going to be tricky finding my way, there was a bridge crossing.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be doing a river crossing in the dark. So I had to find the bridge. That was a non-negotiable, because that really would have been a life or death decision. There was literally ice, and the river was relatively deep.
Yeah.
I didn't really have much of a means of warming up if I'd got really, really wet. So, but I found the bridge and made it and all of that. And then, of course, I had to do all the same thing in reverse the following day. Yeah. It was very, very cold. It was minus 10.
Yeah.
Overnight, it was colder than that. So, you know, you're looking at serious conditions to be in on your own. And that's really what perhaps characterises these two experiences. And most of the time when I've been doing the sort of things that Alex is trying to find out about, it's usually with a mate, with a mountaineering friend, where you look out for each other, you look after each other, and then of course, by far the best way to do it. And I wouldn't really recommend to anybody to go out on their own. I'm sure Alex has probably done it, and some brave souls will do, but it's not really the right thing to do.
Even in terms of hypothermia, because it's a good sanity check to have somebody
Absolutely,
else.
Absolutely. And you need to have very good self-awareness. And hypothermia is the biggest killer on the hills of our islands. It doesn't have to be very cold for you to get hypothermia. It's much more about managing your comfort. You actually owe it to yourself to understand how your body works and what's going on. Mm. And early stage hypothermia is easy to recognise. That's a time you really, really have to do something about it.
You merge into the irrational very quickly, don't you?
Relatively speaking, once time goes by and you're not getting warm, then things can go from difficult to bad very quickly, and then from bad to worse. So, yeah.
Worth a look at the article, that one, though. Our next question, it's from David Bickerdike, and he says, I'd like to ask Joe, please, if he was starting out in landscape photography now, in these days of digital cameras where everyone is a photographer, would he have found it much harder, and also whether professional landscape photography is long-term sustainable, given the above? And he finishes with, what are the ways of making money are there?
Well, it's an insightful question, and I think that in reflection, I think that, okay, so there's a few questions in there. One is it harder? I think that it probably is, but I think it's also important to remember it's always been hard. And in many ways, it's to make a living as a landscape photographer has always been very, very difficult. And I've only ever made a living that way through stock. And there was a period when I was doing sufficiently well from stock to be able to say, yes, I make a living as a landscape photographer, but it wasn't a very long period.
Yeah.
It really wasn't. And also, was that pure landscape? No, it wasn't. It was largely travel, what you might call generic travel photography, some of which was landscape photography, but not what we might typically characterise as creative or perhaps artistic landscape photography. So to an extent, you know, to answer David's question, I don't think it's that much different than it's ever been. Is it long-term sustainable? I think it is if you remember that landscape photography itself probably never has been and isn't likely to be in itself a complete source of income unless you are one of perhaps a small handful of people who, you know, if we think of, say, Michael Kenner, who most people will know of, and some American photographers who have a high reputation and gallery representation, and they can make a living from prints. But even they, you know, they don't necessarily make a fortune.
Yeah.
They might seem like very expensive prints, but they aren't selling them in sort of quantities that's going to make them into a multimillionaire or anything like that.
Yeah. And in America, there's a lot bigger market for photography and prints, particularly because of the amount of, well, the size of the market and the size of people's houses. It's probably a...
Exactly. I think many people will know Peter Lick, for example, who's a successful landscape photographer in the States with a number of galleries, and he's a bit of a recent addition to the gallery scene there. I think that there are other photographers who predate him who have perhaps among the photographic community a higher reputation. I think that Michael Fatali, for example, and trying to remember who the natural history photographer based in Colorado is. There's a number of them, but...
Rodney Love Jr. is a Californian.
It's not who I was thinking of, but yes. And Jim Brandenburg, I'm sure, has a gallery representation.
He's just opened a gallery next to Peter Licks, actually.
Right.
Is it Jim Brandenburg or... No, I don't think it is, but yes.
The point is, we can think of name photographers, can't we? In the UK, it's really not a business model that I'm aware of. I mean, I have a gallery, but the gallery mainly is I think it's important to emphasise this, and maybe this will come up later, that it exists to you know, as an independent business. It's not really mine in that sense, and for it to prosper as a business, it has to focus on its priorities, not on mine. But that's another story. I was just going to say, in terms of David's second part of his question, he actually goes on to say, what are the other ways of making money? Well, that is how I make a living as a photographer, is not just by my photography, but by doing workshops, by writing some TV presentation work, although you have to say that doesn't pay very much at all, at some mentoring and sort of consultancy work, but it's a little bit haphazard, and it's very much a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Would you say that, I mean, having been in the stock photography market and having seen people like Colin Pryor, who did exceptionally well, and then obviously the income from that settled off and had to change, do you think that's a continuous thing? It's a given that things will change. So anything you find that works as a business idea now or a business process will only be temporary, probably, and something else will change in the future.
Yes, so I think that's a good way of looking at it, because you might think there are kind of hardy perennials. I mean, I think when my friends and I started working on the card business, about 12, 13 years ago, we probably thought that, well, there'll always be a market for greetings cards. Well, yes, there is, but it's a definitely declining one. And I don't think we can't guarantee it'll go on forever. So there have been cartes de visite since 1860. So that clearly there's a great past to it, but, and that was postcards and greetings cards in a way came later. So Colin does calendars. Colin is one of the biggest selling calendar businesses in the country, and he's been hugely successful with that. Great credit to him. It's very, very difficult as a kind of quote-unquote celebrity photographer, if you think of Colin in that way, for him to continue on that model. He'll have to reinvent. I believe everybody will. If calendars continue, well, I'm sure most of us hope they will, then it will still change.
Yeah.
Eventually, perhaps, it will change completely. We're all perhaps a bit wandering in this world of screens and tablets and and smartphones. How sustainable are paper products?
Yeah.
I suspect the market for paper products will narrow. I don't think it'll disappear,
yeah,
but it will narrow and it'll change. And yes, we'll have to adapt to that.
The next question we have is from, I believe it's Samantha Murray, S.A. Murray. Does Joe feel his best work is made closer to home or in less familiar locations, and why?
This is a lovely question, because it's one of those where you can you can easily contradict yourself in the
yeah.
process of answering it, and I expect that's going to happen to me. I think if you'd asked me this 5 years ago, I would have said for sure close to home, because part of me feels that that's the right thing to say, and yet, is it really true? I think that in a very simple way, when you work close to home, you get to know the area really well, and so you can develop a kind of a language, of compositional language, and also then you can start planning and plotting, well, how might this idea
yeah.
work really well in terms of lighting and in terms of the seasonal side of it. And so that becomes that became for me a kind of methodology, and it still remains a working practice. That's how I essentially keep myself in trim,
yeah.
photographically speaking, is by remaining on good terms with my local area, walking the pathways, and it's also a way of keeping fit and testing myself photographically. My local area is a lovely area. It's actually not necessarily, strangely enough, my kind of the sort of area that I would necessarily look for in the realms of my imagination, because
yeah.
I'm a mountain and coast person, probably above all things, and the moors are almost more of a challenge to me rather than necessarily the first place I would look to in the realm of my imagination. So is my best work done there? I would say not necessarily, but certainly the work that a lot of it means a lot to me because of the personal connections and the memories and all of those things. I think, though, that the question might, perhaps a better way of answering it is to think about the difference between familiarity and novelty and how they influence you artistically. And the great thing about novelty is that then all sorts of, it can be quite liberating too. So, for example, this year I've had two amazing trips, one to Ladakh and another to South Africa. The Ladakh trip was primarily a personal journey with friends and family, but the South Africa trip was most definitely a photographic trip. And I was in a completely new place without a lot of expectation, with not a lot of prior knowledge of the place at all.
Yeah.
And I almost deliberately didn't research it.
Yeah.
So when I went there, it was very instinctive, very. Very much, well, whatever happens, and I'll respond to what I see, and I'll respond to my feelings about it at the time, and photograph both in a way that's a documentary record, but also a response. And it was, for me, it was productive. And I'm not saying what I did there was great, or would have competed in any way with those with much more local knowledge, but it was. I think creatively very good for me, and there are a few images that I'm proud of because I found myself seeing things in a way that were perhaps I wouldn't have done at home. Perhaps I wouldn't have had the opportunity to, because the types of landscapes were different and new, and the conditions, oddly enough, the mist and the rain that I worked in South Africa, for goodness sake,
yeah.
Unexpected, and I found myself doing things and looking at things in ways where I might never have considered them before in back home. So it was very productive, I believe, for me. And I'm sure I'll transfer some of the ideas and the kind of the methods even that I worked with over there back home as well. So I think there is a blend that needs to be struck. You know, what I've learned from doing work close to home has been enormously important, especially in terms of workflow and practice. But creatively, the sparks that fly when you go somewhere new and you have that, the stimulus of the new, are tremendously important as well. So to me, like, as I'm sure I'm going to say this again, balance is all.
So when you're out locally, but do you work instinctively then, or are you typically looking at a location? Do you go somewhere because you've got something expected?
I think that there is a probably planning does come into it, and it certainly has done a lot in the past. Well, now I try to give myself more of an open brief when I am local, but you can't get away from the fact that it's still local, and there's still sort of things that the expectation is there, and the kind of, and because you want to make the most of your time, you tend to think, well, now the sky's doing that, therefore I will go to such and such a place.
And presumably you've built up a dictionary of possible pictures over time, so everywhere you go there's a, oh, I'd thought about that before, I've thought about this before.
Well, that's true, and one of the dangers is, especially when you've been successful in a particular place, there's a great temptation to go back there and see if you can improve on what you did before.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a good idea.
Yeah,
definitely isn't. You know, and a big part of, I think, being creative is to always, is never to repeat yourself. But actually, yes, you can say, well, if there's something that's work in progress where you know that you could keep developing an idea until you, as it were, fulfill its potential. Yeah. Fair enough. But once you've done that, then I think it's important to move on.
Keep away from it for a bit.
Yeah.